Chapter 4, Building the School. The first night. My mind was a whirlwind as I lay in the dark. I worked through each spiral, seeking ways out of the crushing coil, and each time I drew a blank, my mind filled with verse. The lines of How Gilbert Died by Banjo Patterson would not be stemmed. But Gilbert wakes while the night is dark, a restless sleeper, aye. He has heard the sound of a sheepdog's bark and his horse's warning neigh, and he says to his mate, "There are hawks abroad, and it's time that we went away." Gilbert, a restless sleeper, cornered, done, cornered. Gilbert and Dunn, Ben Hall, Ned and Dan Kelly, bush rangers in Australian folklore, netted before death, trapped. What misgivings had they felt? How easily had they resigned themselves to their fate? Had it been a blessing when troopers offered them the ultimate escape? Did a bullet oversimplify the answer to my perceived entrapment? God, such a depressing notion had never before entered my head. Through the few years I had lived, same-age friends had empowered me with leadership status and respected where I'd taken them in debate or in pursuit of frolic, and most definitely on the sports fields. Pessimism had no place here. But alone, with my life's possessions still stashed in the suitcase under a metal cot, optimism was as delicate as gossamer. I lowered the cotton sheet that stretched over my sunburned face. A mosquito landed. My head rang as I slapped at it. A whining drone spoke of legions more. Clever little bastards, I thought, infiltrating the wire mesh. "We are sold," he said. "We are dead men, both. Still, there may be a chance for one. I'll stop and fight with a pistol here. You take to your heels and run." The single cot out on the narrow back veranda was the coolest bed in Bunny's home, but even without my worries and without the taunting mosquitoes, there were enough distractions to keep sleep at bay. A pageant of stars floodlit the great expanse overhead, testing my sense of constellations. Ever constant was the Southern Cross. A rhythmic creaking of tin and wire grated on my nerves, and I could see the outline of a windmill. Four metal blades quivered, trying to capture the slightest breeze for water to be drawn from an artesian source. The mournful sounds expressed hopelessness at the task. A gas generator in its little shed throbbed like a heartbeat, renewing batteries for the demands of another day. More distant, but of genuine intrigue, sounds of uncertain activity echoed from the Aboriginal camp, like adjusting to the passage of evening traffic in a city or the restless shuffling of a few chickens. I knew I would have to make companions of these alien noises for sleep to be automatic. Bunny and Dorothy Horval were snoring unevenly in an adjoining room. One of the four children coughed somewhere. The little home was full, and still they had taken me on as a boarder. Well, they had had no choice. The only other residence was the Wilmer Ingle homestead about 300 yards away. The homestead would have been more suitable, providing a separate room and perhaps a closet. But its lone occupant, the manager, Eric Matheson, apparently had no authority to take in itinerants on a permanent basis. If the manager had made an effort to make my acquaintance, moral support for any comer to a new situation helps establish threads of belonging. His thoughtfulness would have gone far to alleviate my feelings of isolation. But he had not, and a hard truth prevailed. There'd be no mentor here, no playmates, male or female, and I'd be obliged to call upon whatever strengths I had to see how resourceful and independent my character really was. And this thought raised the larger question. The issue was not who any of these outback people were or what they were about, but rather, who was I? 20 was too young for me to contemplate such philosophy. "This is it," Bunny had said, so simplistically, hardly realizing the indelible imprint of his casual remark. What with that and the blunt telegram, my life was being drastically altered by a few chance words. I offered up my thoughts to the parading stars. Why me? Who determined I would be the first teacher at Wilmer Ingle? What rationale was behind that choice? Shortly after our arrival, I had followed Bunny across a sand patch, no more than a stone's throw from his home, to where two men were erecting a wooden frame on a small slab of concrete. The sand was incredibly hot. "Here's your school. Should be enough, don't you think?" Bunny remarked with a degree of excitement. Was he mad? So Dunn crept out on his hands and knees in the dim half-dawning light, and he made his way to a patch of trees and was lost in the black of night. The structure measured 10 paces long and 3 paces wide, little bigger than a cricket pitch. Fibro-cement sheeting was being nailed to the hardwood frame, which allowed for 6 small windows and a door. The roof rafters sloped from back to front. Though I tried to imagine desks inside the shell, there was not the faintest resemblance to a school. Schools of my recollection were wooden floors and fluorescent lights, blackboards and books, chalk and inkwells. Schools were registers and radio broadcasts, watercolors, bells and flags, dusters and footballs, maps, globes, charts and fountains. Schools were pianos and test tubes and set squares and magazines, canes, curtains, hula hoops and skipping ropes. Schools were playhouses for children. My school was a chicken shed. I was introduced to Len Davis and John Mann, and Len, pointing to a stack of heavy corrugated iron sheets fully exposed to the sun, said, "The sheeting for the roof is 6 inches too long. Somebody's got to trim them." And the look he gave me through the thick lens of his glasses left little doubt who the someone was. No matter the size of the task, if it had to be done, I usually went right at it. What was the point of mentioning that trimming roofs and hammering rafters was outside my professional duties? School began in 2 days. I attacked the metal sheets feverishly with a blunt pair of tin snips and worked steadily all afternoon, grateful my father had instilled in me an admirable work ethic. By sundown, my hands bled like raw steaks. "No problem." "They'll appreciate your effort," John Mann said. Who is they, I thought, not that it made any difference. I was finally here representing them, and not about to quit just yet. I didn't require their presence to exact an honest accounting of my effort or tell me whether building the school had been an oversight. They would not concern themselves with thought of my hardship. There were so many isolated postings to be filled in New South Wales that authorities could only gamble that the Australian panache would stand fast, that the country's youth they scattered west would go blissfully onward, calling back, "She'll be right, mate, no worries." Or was it possible that someone had studied files to identify special traits for this assignment? Had some bureaucrat in an air-conditioned office found in my records a pawn with the attributes of a more regal chess piece? If I was to punish my physical and mental self in this semi-desert, better to believe someone, somewhere, thought I was capable of getting the job done. Len Davis led by example, powerful with the shoulders and neck of a bull. He swung the wall frames into place without help. When I steadied adjoining sections to free him to hammering, he commented in a soft voice, "Glad to have you here at last." And I replied automatically, "Glad to be here," hardly considering it a lie. Like Bunny, Lenny was in the outback voluntarily and seemed pleased with the life, and I asked, "Will you have youngsters attending the school?" "Sure will. Robin's 8 and Michael's 5. Robin's been on correspondence the last 2 years. She reads quite well. It will be a bit of a drive getting the kids here, but worth it, we hope." "Where do you live?" "Over on the next property but one, out past Jim Bridges' place, about 30 minutes as the crow flies. It's a small place, 17,000 acres. Beryl and I call it Burbar, as it's on the Burbar Creek at the bottom end of the Nebine. One of these days we hope to buy another section." 17,000 acres? Lenny removed his glasses. His right eye looked like glass. He put things into perspective. "Wilmer Engel station is 40,000. It was 500,000 acres before the war." Len explained how the New Zealand and Australian Land Company, a corporation based in Scotland, had purchased Wilmer Engel in 1926. Following World War II, the Soldiers and Settlers Act decreed the estates of absentee landowners to be cut up to provide blocks for veterans and open selectors. Through the luck of the draw, Len's number had come up in a lottery, and he jumped at the opportunity to move west and develop his selector's block. He had come with hope and vigour and stayed because he believed life at Burbar offered the best of futures for his family. 10 years of relentless labour had realised a homestead, created a network of irrigated troughs across the property for subsurface water, he called these bore drains, and installed a system of fence paddocks in which sheep could be mustered and rotated. They were productive, though not always prosperous, times, but Lenny showed no signs of resentment against the West. His sentiments for his land seemed heartfelt. "We only have 2,000 head at the moment. The drought's the problem. You can only run one sheep for every 7 acres at the best of times, and it hasn't rained for 2 years. Bunny probably told you that." John Mann was in his early 30s and lived with his wife Pat and 2 children on what he referred to as the Wilmeringle outstation. The children were too young to attend school, but his effort was no less industrious. He worked for the educational future of his children. Like Lenny, he spoke in fond terms of the land, even obsessively, and I was reminded of the dragonfly. It crossed my mind that I was missing something. Another mosquito came to scout my roasted flesh. I flexed a cramped hand, feeling the blisters tear again, and dabbed the leaking bubbles on the sheet before swiping angrily into the darkness. Then out of the shadows the troopers aimed at his voice and the pistol sound. With rifle flashes and darkness flamed, he staggered and spun around, and they riddled his body with rifle balls as it lay on the blood-soaked ground. Hell!